Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm doing Berg Frankenstein. My exclusive source is Wikipedia, and I mean a lot of Wikipedia pages, but it's still just Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So the castle is located on the top of the hill in the Odenwald, overlooking Darmstadt and Hesse, Germany. It's not like specifically near Darmstadt, which is a bigger city. But it's like in like a slight highland area. Darmstadt's in lowlands. So the castle was originally constructed as part of an 80-kilometer, 50-mile-long mountain trade route that linked Darmstadt to Weißlauch. So it's like lowland to highland trade route. I assume the castle served as sort of like a fortified stop along the way, because there's like perpetual robbing happening for most of human history on trade routes.
That's how it goes.
So if you fortify little things, then if you can get to that in the nighttime, you're good, you know? The castle was constructed sometime before 1250 by Lord Conrad II, Ries von Brauberg. And then after he makes the castle, he gives himself and any progeny he has, any descendants, the name von and zu Frankenstein, and founds a free imperial barony, the free imperial barony of Frankenstein, making himself and any future descendants rulers of the land. So he builds a castle and says, I'm king, basically. It's not king. That's a different position, and he's not that, and he knows he's not that, but it's sort of like, getting a farm and saying, now I am mayor.
Mayor of all that I can see.
But he is given jurisdiction by the emperor, I assume the Holy Roman Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
He's given jurisdiction over the towns of Niederbierbach, Darmstadt, Okstadt, Wetterau, and Hesse. And then he has sovereign rights as Burggraves, which is another form of, I think it's more like governor, where like they have their own governing system, but they still have to sort of refer back to him. Anyway, he's whatever this position is, he's that. And Zwingensberg, Auerbach, von Bensheim, and then also in Darmstadt, I think he has different, Darmstadt might have some independence at some point in history, and it's confusing. Either way, Karl, Frankfurt am Main, and Bensheim. And then the rest of that's just me saying what that position sort of means from what I understand, because there's not a lot of direct translations for some of the words that I encountered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because no one's ever needed to translate them, basically. You just know what it is. It's one of those feudal positions that only existed in that space, so you don't need a word for it in English, because we didn't necessarily have an equivalent. 1292, the Frankensteins formed an alliance with the Katz-Ellenbogen family, which led the castle to being split between the two families for a little bit, starting in 1363, and then that lasted until the 1400s, after which the Frankensteins were the sole owners of the castles again. Katz and Ellenbogen is really funny because it literally means the cat's elbow. That's not where the family name actually comes from. It just sounds like that. So the first document referring to the castle dates to 1252. During Reformation, Martin Luther was not going to be finding refuge in the castle, as they were staunch Catholics. And that, like, basically every castle said, I am either pro or against the concept of Reformation during that time frame. Mm-hmm. And that means either Martin Luther stopped by and said, hey, here's my spiel, or he didn't.
Yeah.
He was also seeking refuge whenever he was there, given the spiel, if they wanted to give it, but they were not one of the ones visited by him. Reformation and territorial conflicts led to the castle losing its seat of power. So it's no longer in control of the land around it. It's just a castle. And it was used for as a hospital for a time. I don't know when or how long or what kind of hospital. It fell into ruin in the 1700s. Currently, the castle sports two towers that are the result of a historically inaccurate reconstruction, which was very common. From yeah. You sort of like, oh, this castle's in disrepair. Let's make it cute. And then they'd make it cute. So now we're going to get to some of the stories from this region. So I was like sort of looking for ghost stories, but Germany's not big on ghost stories. They're more big on like local legends and like what we would call cryptids, but they call like, you know, fairy tale creatures. Mm-hmm.
Why don't they have ghost stories? They don't believe in ghosts?
Not really, no. Their big thing is like doppelgangers. So first is Lord George and the Dragon. This legend was either written or recorded by, either created by this man or recorded as, you know, like Grimm Brother style, like he was just recording
mm-hmm.
local stories. I don't know which one. But it was recorded by August Nordnagel in the early 1800s. The story goes that long ago, a dragon lived in the garden near Castle Frankenstein, specifically near the well that was in this garden. The villagers of the nearby town being Niederbierbach, feared the dragon, which was said to creep around at night and eat the villagers and their children in their sleep. That's a fair reason to be scared of a dragon. One day, Lord George, a knight...
Are they, like, sleeping outside?
No,
or is he breaking into their house?
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
No, they're not just, like, all camping outside.
Well, I don't know.
They're in their homes and breaking in. Does he have opposable thumbs? I think he's just going through the windows. Most people don't have...
Yeah, I guess they do leave windows.
Like, down the chimney, you know, like, there's ways to get in. Not even sure you're necessarily always locking doors then. So, one day, Lord George, a knight, rode into town, and the villagers sought him out to help them with their dragon problem. So the next day, George puts on his armor, rides up to Castle Frankenstein, where he finds the dragon resting on the well in the sun. George hoped... George hopped off his horse and attacked the dragon. They fought. The dragon breathes fire and steam at him. It's a really equal fight. They fight for a very long time to the point where they're both entirely exhausted. At the last minute, the knight kills the dragon. Finally gets that sword just right. And as the dragon is like falling down dead, a poison spike stabs George and they both die. It's tragic. the knight is said to be buried in a tomb at the church cemetery in town. I believe that is still claimed to be the case, that tomb still exists, which is really surprising because Germany practices, like, every X amount of years you sort of bury over the old stuff. Like, you mm-hmm. remove the stones and put, like, no one remembers who's here anymore. Time to put the next set of dead, basically. And it's like a 200-year rotation kind of thing. So they make, like, tells of cemeteries. Interesting. Just get taller and taller and taller. So it's rare to find really old gravestones in Germany because of mm-hmm. that. So, like, usually you're lucky if you find ones from, like, the 1700s.
Yeah.
Because they've since stopped doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They've been finding alternative methods, but there's not really, really old tombstones. The older ones will be, like, in the churches, like, important people buried in the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So in the herb garden... This is another story now. We finished the story of George and the dragon. In the herb garden, there's said to be a fountain of youth, which is very interesting. And this one's like a super localized story. This is not going to be like a widespread
yeah.
one. People aren't coming here for this fountain of youth because it's part of it is focused on like a ritual you have to do beforehand. So it's not going to be something that people are coming far and wide to participate in. And it's also just for old women. So, in the Woo-hoo. Herb garden around this castle, there's said to be a fountain of youth that only works on the first full moon after Walpurgisnacht. And on that night, the old women of Niederbierbach compete in a test of courage. I don't know what the test is. Either way, they compete in a test of courage, and whoever wins it gets to go and be rejuvenated in the fountain and just, like, comes, you know, goes in old, comes out. 20, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, theoretically, you could live forever if you were always the one winning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a yearly option. So the whole town of old women can live forever. You just, one person every year wins. You could create a undying group of witches in that town.
Yeah, you could. Maybe they are.
It could be. But I thought that was... I like the little local lore. I was really excited when that was included in the stuff.
Sorry if anybody hears Aubrey breathing.
She's right next to the microphone.
She's very close to the microphone, and she's shoved her, like, nose into the ground.
It is said that in the 1700s, a fortune teller told locals that there was a hidden treasure near the castle, like, somewhere on the hillside that the castle's located on. So in 1763, people came from all around and just started to dig into the hillside, which is not great for erosion. And this digging that just a whole bunch of people were doing only stopped when Johann Heinrich Dott was killed when a tunnel collapsed. So authorities were like, we gotta calm down, guys. It's getting dangerous. It only stopped for a little bit, though, because and then in 1770, 1787, and 1788, further attempts were made to find this treasure until it was entirely, the practice was banned by local authorities, just not allowed anymore. I don't think there's a treasure. I think it was just someone pulling a scam, but...
Yeah.
Because those people all had to stay somewhere and buy things from someplace, and that usually means that some specific business owner in town is making money. On Mount Ilbis, which is a hill near the castle, compasses don't work, which is due to the presence of magnetic rocks in the area. This is a true thing on this mountain. There's a lot of magnetic rocks. Compasses do not work on this mountain.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, this area used to have, and I mean... millions of years ago used to have volcanic activity, so it has a whole bunch of really weird rocks. Sort of like the area around here in Missouri around Elephant Rock, where like Elephant Rock is because of that, Johnson Shut-In is because of that, and then you know those like, I don't remember if they're hexagonal or if they're octagonal, like stones, like the Giant's Walkway in Ireland. That shaped stone, we have a mountain that's just that here.
Do we?
Yeah, we do. Me and James went to it once because like I gotta see it. It's just those rocks, just like any other place in the world that has it. You know, like Devil's Tower is made out of them, too.
Weird.
But like that kind of volcanic stone. I don't know if that's necessarily around here, but there's similar things where there's a lot of volcanic activity long, long, long time ago. So there's a bunch of weird rocks. So the area is a little different than the surrounding area. Some say that these stones were used on Walpurgisnacht rituals and during the summer solstice by... you know, pre-Christian religions, local witches, whoever you want to say was doing things there. I don't think there's any proof. I think it's just modern local lore because it's fun to say. And it also might be modern local American lore of German places. That's a hard thing to sort of pick out when, because I didn't use the German sources because I didn't need to. It's just, it's faster for me to read English. But in a lot of English sources of German things, because there's been such a long American like occupation there with the what is that, military base or bases, there's at least one, but like people, a lot of people end up living in Germany briefly as Americans if they're connected to the military, so they get to make up their American style local legends of places between their like mixed understanding and just the need for having fun like anybody else does when they're bored. So sort of hard to pick those out. Someone says it is the second... Some say that this mountain, this weird magnetic mountain, is the second most important location for witches in Germany after Mount Brocken. This is another one that I think might be connected to American legends and not German tradition, because I've never heard Germans speak about witches in that way.
Yeah.
They don't deny them at all, but they're not, there's not like covens.
This is where the witches
gather. Does
that
make sense? They don't have like coven stories. They don't have like, yeah, they're never conspiring. It's just the old lady in the woods happens to know how to use the herbs and nature better than the others. And you go for help sometimes there, and sometimes she's good and sometimes she's bad, depending on if you're good or bad. That's witches in Germany. So another place near the castle is... this large Felsenmeer, which is related to the volcanic activity a long time ago. A Felsenmeer is like a big sea of rocks. And it's like a huge, it really is a big, big field. I went and looked it up. huge field of large boulders. So sort of, again, if you're familiar with Elephant Rock, sort of similar to that, but more rocks, more individual round boulders over a very large swath of area. And this is a very significant area in, like, the great mythology that Germany has, which Germans have, it's a better way to say that, which is, like, the Nibelungenlied, which is, like, a really, really old epic poem. Mm-hmm. So, like the Iliad, the Odyssey, Beowulf, and there's a few other ones. The Edda, the Poetic Edda, but there's a whole bunch of really big epic poems, which is the way they're all orally shared for a long, long time, and they're pretty oral traditions like that are generally considered to be semi-accurate to, like, crazy things that did happen in the past. And so the one that's sort of centralized in what is now German territory is Nibelungenlied. The hero for that is Siegfried, and he does a whole bunch of epic things, like killing a dragon and taking on Brunhild, the evil queen of Iceland, so on and so forth. And he has been blessed by, I don't know if it's the gods or some other form of magic, but he has a similar protection on him like Achilles does, where he only has, like, one weak spot on him. But only, like, one person knows, the person closest to him, I think in this case it's Kriemhild, his wife, who tells his, like, not his first mate, but I can't think of what that would be in non-pirate terms, non-ocean terms, but, like, his main other human support, who is Hagen, who is not as good as everyone was hoping, and Hagen takes advantage of knowing where his weak spot is and kills him in this Felsenmeer that's near the castle, in this specific spot. This is, like, across the board considered to be the place where Hagen, not necessarily, like, they don't necessarily know exactly where in that Felsenmeer, but, like, this is the general geographic location that Siegfried was murdered by Hagen, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a deep old lore. Johann Conrad Dippel, this is where we really get into the reason that I am covering this castle at all, but I had to cover all the other little weird things that are in the area first.
Yeah.
Because it's not really paranormal. I mean, it's paranormal, but it's not classic ghost version or necessarily true crime. It was just weird. So Johann Conrad Dippel was born in the castle in 1673. He was a well-educated man. He studied theology, philosophy, and alchemy. He studied at the University of Gießen, obtained a master's degree in 1693 in theology. That was his main focus early on, was theology. He wrote and published many theological works under the pen name of Christianus Democritus. Around 1700, he turned his focus away from Christianity. They were pro-Christian writings. He was a Christian man writing about theology and Christianity.
Yeah.
Around 1700, he turns his focus away from Christianity to Hermeticism, which is a philosophy and religion. You can either follow the philosophy of Hermeticism or the religion of it, or both, but they can be separated. Either way, it's the teachings based around this being or person, Hermes Trismegistus. Sure.
I couldn't tell you.
Who is a Hellenistic combination, so ancient Greek combination of the gods Hermes and Thoth, who is an Egyptian god.
Mm-hmm.
Thoth. They combined this person, because they're very similar, into this Hermes Trismegistus, and then wrote down this person's teachings. I don't know how they got there. It wasn't the time and place to fully delve into that religion. That could be a thing later, maybe, but not right now. Either way, this is where alchemy comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Is this philosophy and religion? And alchemy is a lot of things, but, like, the end goal, like, to be the best alchemist possible means you can turn other metals into gold, which is not a thing you can do. But that's like the idea, is that we can eventually manipulate nature enough to make it do what we want it to do.
No.
So alchemy was his main focus within this religion. That's where he starts to turn his academic efforts, specifically how he believed it to be a key part of nature, how alchemy was rooted in nature, was his belief. And that's what he was sort of writing about and exploring. Between 1700 and 1702, he and the reformed court preacher Conrad Porska and Offenbach had a bitter rivalry. I thought it was worth mentioning for later in life. He makes enemies. Hi, Fanny.
Hi, buddy. No.
Making puppy noises.
Sorry for the dog interruptions.
Either way, he has rivalries with other people in the world, and that's mm-hmm. good to know for later down the line. So the specific issue that Busca had was Brusco was pro return of Christianity to academia. He wanted academia to be going through the lens of Christianity and not from any other aspect. So he refused to publish Dipples, Discouraging Papacy of the Protestants. It was a book that he wrote. He refused to publish it on the Offenburg Press. And I assume there's other back and forth, but that was like the really big thing, is that he wasn't allowing Dipple's things to be printed. Dipple had friends and enemies across European academia, both for his like religious standings pre-turn to alchemy, and then also once he was dealing with alchemy on both ends. Some people didn't mm-hmm. like him. Some people did. That's pretty standard in academia. One of his enemies was Emanuel Swedenborg, who called him the most vile devil who attempted wicked things. That's how he's described Dipple. Swedenborg was originally a fan of Dipple's writings, but later criticized Dipple as bound to no principles, but was in general opposed to all, as in all principles, whoever they may be, of whatever principle or faith, becoming angry with anyone for contradicting him. So at the end of the day, Dipple thought, based on Swedenborg's comment on Dipple, Dipple didn't like it when people didn't agree with him perfectly mm-hmm. 100% of the time, which is also very common in academia. Swedenborg also accused Dipple of purposefully leading people away from faith by taking away all their intelligence of truth and good and leaving them with a kind of delirium. And this is sort of the idea that people are just... I've not specifically read Dipple's writings, but I think a lot of the issues people had with him is he was making people agnostic and atheist on accident, basically.
Making people question
They're questioning things. The concept that there has to be a religion, basically. And they don't like that, because religion gives a lot of power.
A lot of money.
He was imprisoned for heresy and served 7 years once. I don't know where. he created a panacea / snake oil called Dipple's Oil. it was an oil made by distilling animal bones.
Interesting.
He believed it to be, and was marketing it as an elixir of life.
I mean, hey, it is.
But it was better used, and this is genuinely better used, as an animal and insect repellent. But some people used it that way and it worked. And then it was also used as a chemical weapon during World War II. not like they were like using it like tear gas or mustard gas. They would use it to render wells undrinkable. They would just
poison
the water supply with Dipple's oil, which is just distilled animal bone. He tried to use the elixir. He like literally tried to like, here's the recipe and mm-hmm. like the profits from it. He was basically selling the patent to it to try to buy Castle Frankenstein once, mm-hmm. and they said no. Once while experimenting with red dyes, while working with the pigment maker Diesbach, So, like, Diesbach is a famous pigment maker. Dipple was working with him for a time, exploring red dyes for whatever reason. They were just sort of, like, adding different chemicals to stuff to see what red dyes they would make. They added the oil, as in Dipple's oil, to potassium carbonate, trying to make another hue of red, and accidentally made Prussian blue, which is a very, like, famous and noteworthy color in, like, art history, basically. Yeah. Like, if you've taken an art history class and were paying attention, Bob you would Ross, know.
I'm pretty sure he talks
know,
about
Prussian
it.
Prussian blue, if you're gonna know a weird random color that exists, like a weird random pigment, it's gonna be Prussian blue, basically.
That's funny.
He invents it on accident with his weird oil. Which is really funny, because that makes it, as long as people remember Prussian blue, they'll remember him. That, that was the one thing that he needed to do. There were rumors that were made that Dipple was staying in the castle when it collapsed, as in the Frankenstein castle, because it did collapse, because it was going into ruin in the 1700s, because no one was using it, and that's what happens. either way, they say specifically he collapsed the tower while he was working with nitroglycerin. This is really unlikely, though, because nitroglycerin wasn't discovered yet. And then there's absolutely no record of the tower collapsing during his lifetime, and that would have been written down somewhere if that's when it had specifically collapsed. It's just a fun tale, because they know that he is connected to it and did experiment with lots of things. Another legend says that Dipple, like many other people of the time, was experimenting on cadavers in the castle. Again, very common thing to do during then, because they literally didn't know what germs were. They were trying to figure out what the body was, right? On cadavers?
Cadavers.
Oh, cadavers, you're right. What are cadavers? Nothing?
I don't think.
Cadavers.
What are cadavers?
Dead bodies. He's experimenting on dead human bodies. They don't know that. They're expecting
it. Well, I couldn't tell if I had heard you say it wrong at first. I didn't expect you to say it the same way the second time.
Anyway,
it's too early for this.
Part of the legend that is that he was experimenting on dead bodies, and that he was eventually driven out of town by locals because of it, because they found out and they thought that was gross.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah, where's he getting them from, you know?
Yeah.
That's the bigger thing, usually, is that he's stealing bodies from somewhere, or he's murdering people. Not that he... Again, not saying he's doing any of these things. This was just a local legend.
Yeah.
And I sort of think this is where the legend comes from, because it is well recorded that he was banned from Sweden and Russia for his theological writings, that he was made to flee Gießen for killing a man during a duel. But as these other places where he was blatantly banned from or fleeing from were well recorded, I think he would be recorded of being banned from this town as well, basically. However, that doesn't mean he wasn't experimenting on cadavers. One, because some of his writings suggest that he was definitely doing that. And also, again, for the field that he was in, that was the standard thing to do. It wouldn't be like this. It's not him being weird. That's just, like, that's what the science was at the time. That's still what science is now. We still do experimentation on dead human corpses. Like, that's not a crazy thing to do. And considering he was doing that much work with animal bones, I'm assuming he was doing things with human ones, too. So, in Maladies and Remedies of the Life of the Flesh, which is one of his writings, he says, not only did he discover the elixir of life, but he also discovered the means of exorcising demons using a potion made from animal bones. And I do believe that means that his oil was something that he also thought could exorcise demons from the human body, which is curious. And I want to know what that means exactly, but I don't know.
I wonder if the Catholics looked into that.
Oh, I bet they did. But maybe that's why he was the heresy.
Yeah.
I wonder if someone used it. He's like, honestly, this is a rough case. Let's try the oil. He says it might do it.
What if it worked and that's why they sent him to jail?
Oh, no.
Because they wanted to take it as their own.
Oh, you know? You never know. In the same essay, he also talks about the fact that he thinks you can transfer souls from one corpse to the other using a funnel.
I mean, have we tried it?
To be fair, no,
and then, like, I haven't. Reanimated them?
I don't know. I haven't personally. I don't know if anyone's done it in the last 200 years either to know if that's the case. I don't know if anyone tried it after him. Later in life, he loses all faith in Christianity and turns all of his energy, because, like, in the middle there when he starts with alchemy, I think he's straddling both sides, but eventually he just abandons it entirely. All of his energy is into alchemical experimentation. At this point, when he's no longer interacting with Christianity at all, his records on him go more vague because people aren't... He's no longer writing things that are going to make the church mad, basically, because he's not including the church in anything. So yeah, there's just fewer and fewer details about him and his works. And this is sort of when the folklore about his work starts to grow, obviously, because there's gaps that people can fill.
Yeah.
So some of the stories are a local minister accused him of grave robbing to experiment on the bodies, as well as keeping company with the devil. Nothing seems to have come of that accusation if it happened. There's also a story that, and these are like local stories about him, that he sold his soul to the devil in exchange for secret knowledge. And these would have been, like, sort of contemporary with him, not, like,
I'd like to know what the knowledge was.
I know, what's the knowledge?
How to expel demons?
No, it's how to transfer the soul with a funnel watcher.
Yeah, there you go, there you go.
It is thought that Dipple may have encouraged these dark sorcerer rumors as it attracted the population that he wanted to attract that are more likely to buy his elixir of life and pay for his knowledge specifically about the philosopher's stone, which sort of makes sense. She's like, yeah, you can keep telling people I'm a dark wizard because then they'll come for me for the dark wizard things and I'll make money. And I respect that.
Yeah.
Some people think that Dipple was a direct inspiration for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And I don't mean like some people are like, and it's this man rather than the fact that I think when people think it's just this guy, I think they're forgetting that everyone else at the time that was in the similar scientific field was doing almost identical things. I think it's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein comes out of people were just experimenting
what
on human bodies
on
a lot. Especially since he doesn't have any big human body experimentations compared to other people that were known to be doing it, and she would have known were doing it based on the people that she was around. The reason people think it's him is because he's directly associated with Castle Frankenstein. And she just... Frankenstein, by the way, is an extremely generic name. It just seems special now because of Mary Shelley's book. Like, it literally means castle of the Frankish people. It's really vague. It's not in any special name that belongs just to, like, one person. Even though it really feels special now. And one last thing. In 1952, John Keel sent three American Forces Network reporters, three reporters from that group to the castle to explore it during a live broadcast, because this is pretty near where the, our military base is in Germany. So, like, this is absolutely a reasonable thing for them to go mess around with. With all of, because these stories were known then. Most of these are not new stories. During the broadcast, reporters said that according to local legend, Frankenstein's monster was to return to the castle that night. And it had been predicted long ago that this is the night that the monster would return to the castle.
No.
Which is just obviously untrue. Either way, one of the reporters is sent down into the castle crypt, where Keel, the guy who had sent the reporters there to begin with, had set up a statue in the middle of the space and had rigged it to fall over once, like, someone had entered the space.
That's
hilarious. He's like, and they're, like, live reporting this, right?
Yeah.
It's like a live streamed radio broadcast. It terrifies the reporter. It frightens all the listeners to the point that both the radio station and the military police at the base were, like, bombarded with calls to go help the men at the castle because Frankenstein's monster had returned.
That's so funny.
And that's my last little story about Bag Frankenstein.
That's funny. Okay, so my story today takes place in Iceland, and I don't know that language.
Like the poetic either.
So, just bear with me on these names, because of course, in true normal fashion, I didn't look up anything on how to pronounce anything beforehand. So...
I can't pronounce English, so...
So today, I'm covering the story of Gryla, the Yule Cat, and the Yule Lads.
Oh, that's fun.
I don't know if it's Gryla, Grayla, but it's going to be Gryla, because that's
I think
how
it just depends on the
that's
accent.
How I said it in my head. So I got my information from wikipedia.org, guidetoiceland.is, and visiticeland.com. So it's like we'll do like a short history, and then each character gets their own little thing.
Like, what their activities are yeah. related to Yule.
So, the concept of Santa in Iceland is very different from what we have here in America. Instead of Santa, they have 13 trolls led by their mother, a child-eating giantess named Gryla. So, for most of the year, it is said that these creatures hide in the lava fortress of Dimmuborgir, which is located...
Dimmuborgir.
Which is located in the Mývatn? Mývatn?
That works.
area of northern Iceland, but others believe... Okay, the other thing is you could definitely look this up and if you don't understand what I'm saying.
This is very accessible.
You can look it up and be like, oh, that's what she said. Area of northern Iceland, but others believe they live in an unknown mountainous area. From the 11th of December to the 24th, they engage in 13 days of mischief. They each have different antics ranging from mischievous to horrifying,
oh, no.
which they indulge in across the country until the end of the Christmas season. So today they have been made to be not as like horrific. And they're no longer depicted as trolls with extreme deformities, but they are now said to wear traditional red and white clothing, have fluffy beards, and wide smiles. So they're just, like, nice, old, jolly Santas, basically.
I think as the world gets less dangerous from the elements, you don't need to be as terrifying to make sure the children stay safe. It's
I
easier to keep the children safe. Does that make sense?
I guess. Instead of pulling pranks, they leave presents in the shoes that children put on their windowsills. Which, what is up with other countries and putting presents in a shoe? Because who else does that? Like, St. Nicholas does
that,
where you leave it on your doorstep.
I think it seems to be pretty even
shoes are so
shoes and
dirty.
Socks.
And they're putting fruits and candy in there. That's just
because
gross to me.
You can wash
me.
A sock easier than you can wash a shoe.
A shoe.
So I understand my socks. I think I'd prefer socks.
I just think that's gross. Okay, anyway. If they were naughty, instead of cold,
but
they'll find potatoes in their
outside,
shoes
so
in the
no
morning.
One has to break in.
Yeah, that's
and I
true.
I think that's part of the shoe thing, is no one has to break into the house.
Yeah. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. Instead of coal, they'll find potatoes in their shoes in the morning.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Or rotten potatoes, depending on
how bad they were. A potato, you're just sort of bad. Rotten, you, like, did bad
you're
things
terrible.
To the cat. Like...
Now we're on to Miss Gryla. So Gryla is one of the longest-standing Christmas traditions in Iceland. She is one of the most evil figures in Icelandic folklore. And she is depicted as having long claws, a tail, hooves, and a menacing expression. Throughout the year, it is said that she collects whispers about children around the island misbehaving, and when winter comes, she goes out to gather them. She takes them and puts them into a sack that she carries on her back, and then cooks them in a pot and turns them into a giant stew that will sustain her until the next winter. It is said that she likes the children softly boiled.
So does that mean the brains are still a little soft?
I don't know. So she doesn't work alone either. She shares her mountain cave with an enormous black cat called the Christmas Cat, which also has an appetite for human flesh.
As most cats do.
So unlike Gryla, the cat does not just go after naughty children. It preys on any child who did not get new clothes to wear for Christmas.
That seems like that's very, like,
against
aggressive
the poor.
Against the poor.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So, Gryla also lives with her husband, a troll named Lepaludi. Sure. But it doesn't seem, I don't know how they put like an emphasis on any part.
Yeah, I don't know the Icelandic cadence.
But it doesn't seem like he does much of anything. He's just described as a lumbering oaf known for his clumsiness. So I don't think he's like mean or evil. I don't even know if he leaves the cave.
He just like lives in the cave.
Yeah. So the Yule Cat, is a large, vicious cat with glowing eyes that prowls the mountains on Christmas night, searching for people who have not received new clothes to wear for winter. And if someone has found an old clothes, it will eat them or steal their food.
Okay, I understand it now. It's saying that if you don't give the gift, then you're basically killing someone. It's encouraging people to give the gift of clothes and help those who may not be receiving them so you don't die by freezing to death because you don't have new clothes. That's the idea.
Here's the origins of this.
Oh, okay.
So winters, I was like, I know I wrote this somewhere, but I didn't know if it was like all the way at the bottom.
Okay.
So winters in Iceland were incredibly dangerous, still are, but mm-hmm. back then when you don't have modern things, it was even worse. Mm-hmm. And many disobedient children who went out in the dark and snow never returned home because... I don't know, snowdrift, whatever.
You fall
into a lake, like whatever.
Remember, it's dark there. They get four hours of daylight.
So there was also a lot of work that needed to get done before the darkest months set in. So it required a lot of extra diligence and effort from every member of the family, including the children. Mm-hmm. So the story that the Christmas cat ate children who did not get new clothes as a gift was likely created to ensure that everybody finished their weaving, knitting, and sewing by the dead of winter.
But it's still basically on the giver.
Yeah.
You need to make sure there's clothes.
Well, you need to make sure you get it done. Yeah. Otherwise, your friend could be dead because of the Yule cat, because of you not finishing.
Okay, so it's not blaming people for being poor. It's blaming people for not...
getting their chores done. Yeah. So Grýla was such a terrifying image to children that in the 18th century, the Parliament of Iceland outlawed the use of her legend as a scare tactic. Kids were no longer threatened with being eaten and instead were given rotten potatoes in their shoes if they were bad.
That's so funny.
I love that. I would still scare my children with that. So we're on to the Yule lads now. So in modern times, and like obviously Grýla's like the... she's the cold of winter. Like, that's why the kids aren't returning home is because of the cold of winter. But that's why Grýla is a thing. So, the Yule Lads. So, in modern times, when December comes, the 13 Yule Lads descend from the mountains to attend celebrations around the country, playing with children and entertaining revelers. They help make Iceland at Christmas more delightful. This was not always the case, because... even though they're not cannibals like their mom was, they would still scare children for, you know, Christmas time things because they just were creepy and did weird things. So adults in Iceland before industrialization also believed in trolls. So it wasn't only kids who were cautious around Christmas time. Like everybody was like, I better get stuff done and these trolls are coming to my house. All of the Yule lads have their own, like, weird...
they all do a specific gimmick.
Yeah. But they all share the features of trolls. They are described as being enormous, filthy, unintelligent creatures. They're humanoid and bestial in, like, the same equal parts. Who can only operate in the hours of night because the sun would turn them into stone. Okay, so here's going to be the names of each 13 trolls, so just get ready for me to mispronounce it at least 13 times. Stekkistor? I don't know. Anyway, that's the first one, which is the Sheepcot Clod. Which I couldn't tell you what those last two words are either. So the first Yule lad to leave the mountains is this man. From the 12th of December until the 25th, he harasses the sheep of any household he comes across. Icelanders would normally keep their sheep underground in the winter months. So they'd hear their sheep, like, bawling.
Bleeding.
And then they would know that he had found their sheep.
Mm-hmm. Darn troll.
He, like most of his brothers, was limited by deformity. So he had stiff legs, I don't know what this typo is. I think it was that he had stiff legs, which impairs his ability to move. So when you'd hear him riling up your herd, the best thing to do is just wait it out, because he still has to get to a neighbor's house, so he won't be at yours long, because he has to get everything done before the sun rises.
He'll just bother people real quick if he's gone, because he's not very fast.
Okay, so Gilliger, is that a J? No. Gilligock is what he's called. He's the second Yule lad to leave the mountains in the winter, from the 13th to the 26th of December. He hides in the gullies around a house, waiting until everyone is asleep, when he breaks in to the cow shed to steal any milk that is available. And by doing this, he is robbing any of the families of a key ingredient in sauces and meat, and like in sauces meant to be enjoyed over the holiday season. So it's like every one of these creatures can like ruin your Christmas in a way. And then the sheep guy, the sheep was like, you know, one of the most important things to them. That's why they kept him safe and underground all winter. So like that's why that guy's scary. Stufer, also known as Stubby, is the third Yule lad, and he goes around stealing the household pans to chew on the crust of them. It's so gross. The 14th to the 27th of December is when he is the most hungry. So pots and pans were valuable because Iceland has no iron reserves or a mining industry of their own.
So
these pots and pans had to be imported, so they were really expensive. And so a lot of the poorer families, it was like the only thing of value in their houses. Mm-hmm. So like the thought of someone coming in and stealing your only valuable thing is like terrible.
You can't cook then.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. The spoon licker.
Hold on. What? It's four? Who's licker?
Anyway, he's the fourth Yule lad, and he sets out on the 15th through the 28th of December every year to break into homes and lick the spoons of each house, trying to get the last drop of whatever is on them. Mm-hmm. It is said that he does this because of his deformity, where he's grotesquely thin from malnutrition, which is strange among trolls because most are depicted as being overweight and muscular. So he's like a tiny little troll with like Prater Willis or something. So,
the Predator Willis would be an issue.
But that's why he could have it.
I think he's just real hungry.
Potaskiffle, the pot scraper. So he breaks into homes looking for pots of sauce, chunks of roast meat left out, saucepans of seasonal vegetables, and eats anything that's left over. Food was meant to be preserved to last through winter, so any waste at meals was frowned upon, is why, like, he's a cautionary tale. And then he comes from the 16th to the 29th of December, but basically, like, whatever you had for dinner, you need to be finishing it, because, like, we only have so much, so why are you not eating what we're giving you?
But also, don't make too much.
You
can't be
wasting anything.
Wasting food by making more than you need.
Askalisker? Bowl licker is known to be the creepiest Yule lad. He has a reputation for slurping the remains of whatever is left in bowls. That's not what's creepy. This is what's creepy. Every night he lays beneath a child's bed and waits for them to finish their nighttime soup or pudding. When they're done, he'll snatch it and eat whatever is left from the 17th to the 30th. So he's, like, kind of what is the origin of monster under your bed.
They're there to steal your soup.
Herdeskeller, the door slammer. Until the end of the... I can't even imagine how badly I'm saying these names.
Let me see that one. I wasn't looking. That's you pronounced it really good. American, I but pronounce I think you said all the letters, I see right?
it. So, until the end of the month, he will sneak from home to home to break into and bang as many doors as he can in order to wake everybody up who's sleeping. The high winds of Iceland winters and the designs of their turn houses kept many children wide awake at night, thinking that this troll was at their house trying to wake everybody up. And this happened from the 18th to the 31st of December, so, like, the high winds or him...
bangs when it's not those dates.
Ghosts. Skyrgamus?
Skyrgamus?
Is that what it's called? It's a, like a, it's a popular dish. Skyr or Skyr.
It's definitely Skyr, not Skyr.
Okay. So this is the Skyr. Will you Skyr?
Skyrgamus?
He's the Skyr gobbler. So the meals leading up to Christmas are some of the best of the year. Just, you know, everybody has their traditional foods. So mince pies, gingerbread men, cinnamon rolls, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Were a big hit. But this one dish is, like, the most, like, special for some reason. It's described, this is how it was described on one of the Iceland websites, is that it's a healthy, tasty dish that is described as one of Iceland's true delicacies. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, so what is you're not telling me what it is? No. Because I was doing this research, but I was like, I've got to get to these 13 trolls. Because there's so many. I was like, oh, I'm only on three. So during Christmas, Skyr is a refreshment from the number of huge roast meals that accompany the holidays. So from the 18th to the 30th, Skyrgamus is on the lookout for any Skyr left unattended.
It's sort of like a combination of yogurt and cottage cheese.
Okay, so this guy is around, apparently, from the 19th of December to the 1st of January. So next is, oh geez,
what's this one?
Bjugnekraker? Bjugnekraker?
Bjugne?
There's not, is that a G or is it an, it's a G.
Bjug?
Bjugnekraker.
Kraker.
The sausage snatcher. So, smoking meat is a popular cooking method in Iceland. Why does that say Ireland? So, smoked fish, lamb, and sausages, known as bjuga, right?
Yeah.
Are the most popular. Starting the night of the 20th through January 2nd, you must keep an eye on any sausage because it is the only food that this troll wants. He breaks into homes, hides in the rafters, and waits for dinner to be cooked before swooping down and snatching them.
You know what's sort of sad is that means, like, poor families that might not have sausage anymore, can they, parents can be like, oh no, the Bjugnekraker stole our sausage, kids, when they didn't have any more, which is sad, but, like, it also makes the kids less sad about their state in life.
Yeah, it does.
Well, the troll stole it.
Glugagager, the window peeper. There's so many. That looks there's like the so same G's. Thing.
It's Glugagagir. That's so many G's.
During the winter, there are only 4 hours of sunlight a day around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So when the sun goes down, children fear walking past their windows because the Glugagagir might be watching them. And he's from the 21st of December through January 3rd.
He's just a peeping Tom.
He just wants to see what's going on. So then we have the Gadathifer, the doorway sniffer.
Gadathifer.
So this could possibly be coming because of the whistling winds that come during wintertime. He is known for his big nose and his nefarious sniffing.
The doorway sniffer.
Seeking out his favorite meal, laufa bread. Leaf bread. This is only baked at Christmas. It is round, thin, fried, and decorated with intricate patterns, usually with leaves. He would often steal any of this bread before anyone could eat any from December 22nd through the 4th of January.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have Ketkrokker, the meat hook, which, like, why wouldn't people be most scared of him? He lurks behind doors, under tables, in cupboards, outside open windows. It does look really good.
The bread's really good looking, yeah.
Waiting for any meat of any dish to be put on the counter, and as soon as he could get it without being caught, he took out his long meat hook and snagged the meat for himself, and he did this from the 23rd of December through January 5th. And then we have the last one. The Karatasnicker. The candle stealer. So the final Yule lad is Karatasnicker. I think that's how you say it. He is seen on Christmas Eve. Candles were very valuable in Iceland because they provided light throughout the winter darkness, which was extremely dark for very long periods of time. They were also the only available tool for Icelanders to enjoy their historically favorite pastime of reading.
What else was there to do when you're stuck inside? Yeah. All the snow.
And over Christmas in Iceland, everyone getting together to read is an old tradition. So, this troll personally doesn't want the candles for reading. He wants them for the tallow that the candles used to be made from. So he would follow the easiest target, the kids, into their rooms or reading nooks and take them right out of their hands.
Oh my gosh.
And this went on from the 24th of December through January 6th. So after Christmas was over, the Yule lads and their mother and her cat all went back into their caves until the next Yuletide. Now that the Yule lads are more family friendly, Kerta Snicker is the last Yule lad to give presents to the kids before Christmas, and his gift to the well-behaved kids is most often a candle.
Like, the sausage stealer gives sausages now.
I don't know. So, the first mention of the Yule Lads was in the 17th century poem of Geirla. Geirla had been written in older stories as a troll, but Greila? Not had been... Oh, yeah, Greila.
Yeah, Greila. However you want to say it, but you flipped the line.
I know. She had been written in older stories as a troll, but had not been linked to Christmas before... until that 17th century poem. She's described as a hideous being who is the mother of the gigantic Yule lads. And that is the story of Greila, the Yule cat, and the Yule lads.
When you, like, go through the order of them, it's like, when you think about your stores for winter, each one is, like, the next, like, in the beginning, the sheep get a little scared. And, like, you don't want them to get out, but they're probably going to be okay. And then, like, it's slowly, like, and then all the meat is gone. And then all the light is gone.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, here's your worst case scenario of, like, a terrible winter. And it's not related to the kids being good or bad in the olden days. It's about...
survival.
It's going to be rough. And we can blame these other things on our situation. Because then we don't have to focus as much on how horrible it actually is. Yeah. It's not like, you better be good, kids.
Well, and, like, the door sniffers, because, like, the wind, the noise of the wind winds can be picking scary, up, so it's getting, just a little troll.
It's just
and,
the troll.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. He'll go away when the winter's over.
So, anyway, that's my story for today. I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
Because, like, you always hear about, like, the traditions, but you only hear, like, the tiniest part of it.
What's nice about these is it's so obvious... because I think, like, the root of tradition is really cool, and it's harder to connect to, like, some of the ones around here, especially, or, like, some of the more common fairy tales. You're like, but what is actually, like, what gets you there? And usually it's, like, a weird sociopolitical thing that creates that story, but this is so painfully obvious what, like, the reasons are for everything, and that's really cool.
Anyway, try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards.
Bye.